I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, a conversation with an economist who says the cost of the war in Iraq is in the trillions, not billions. She also says the U.S. is in deep debt to China to pay for it. We'll explain. But first, at a House Oversight Committee hearing today, Democratic Chair Henry Waxman called American air travel unacceptable, saying there are too many vulnerabilities that still need to be fixed. Today marks the beginning of the biggest travel time of the year. 27 million people are expected to fly worldwide over the next 12 days. And last night, the Government Accountability Office reported that federal investigators smuggled bomb-making components past screeners in 19 American airports over the last year. This despite billions of dollars funneled into the Transportation Security Authority. Well, Los Angeles Times reporter Nicole Gawet is covering today's hearings. We've reached her on a very scratchy cell phone, but Nicole, we're very appreciative that you've stepped out. TSA Administrator Kip Hawley is there. How has he been responding?
The first and foremost was that screeners are just one component in a multi-layered defense system they have. He said they have at least 19 layers that include things like hardened doors and special training for crews in self-defense. The fact that they arm pilots, the fact that there's intelligence gathering that goes on hopefully before would-be terrorists even get to an airport. And so he was arguing basically that if there are vulnerabilities in some part of the system, and he admitted that they exist, that people should not be too worried as they approach this heavy traveling season because there are other nets at work.
And today does mark the beginning of the biggest travel time of the year. 27 million people expected to fly worldwide over the next 12 days. What were some members of the hearing saying, and is it falling along partisan lines?
Actually, this was quite striking. There's a great deal of bipartisan unity in the hearing today. Republicans and Democrats alike are using words like embarrassing and dangerous and dismayed, because a similar test a year ago prompted the TSA to make all kinds of promises that it would improve on screener capability, and one year later, the exact same tests are being failed.
Well, and tell us a little more about what the GAO claimed the investigators did. These were bomb-making materials, and they had assembled them and made a real explosive that could have done a lot of damage. So these were real materials that were being walked through the nation's airports.
They were indeed. And in fact, one of the sort of more colorful and striking parts of the hearing this morning was when GAO investigators screened video of tests of the explosives they brought through these checkpoints. They showed one car trunk, the explosive was placed in the trunk and detonated, and it did considerable damage. The doors flew open, glass shattered, the trunk flew up. Those were chilling demonstrations of how much damage these explosives could do, and the investigators testified that they had been told by explosive and bomb experts that if their homemade samples were placed in the right part of the aircraft, they could bring it down.
That's reporter Nicole Gawet covering the Oversight Committee hearing on airport safety for the Los Angeles Times. She was speaking to us on a terrible telephone cell line. Sorry about that, outside the hearing. This further note about air travel. Washington is also talking today about airline delays. The White House announced today that President Bush will direct the Department of Defense and Federal Aviation Administration to open up unused military airspace to commercial flights in an attempt to reduce air congestion. Crowded skies being felt in airline terminals around the country with passengers and planes waiting for clearance to fly. The Department of Transportation is also proposing forcing the airline to raise the fee paid to travelers if they get bumped from a scheduled flight from $200 to $600. And in cases where flights are chronically delayed by more than 15 minutes, airlines could be charged with using unfair and deceptive practices. That designation also would come with significant fines. Well, a report out this week estimates the cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan is $1.6 trillion, roughly double the amount the Bush administration has requested so far. The report by Congress's Joint Economic Committee also puts a price tag on the war's hidden costs, social and economic costs, including the treatment of wounded veterans, disability payments, and the interest payments on the money borrowed to pay for the war. Critics say the report was politicized. For instance, Democrats didn't show it to Republican colleagues before releasing it. But Linda Bilmes is professor of budgeting and public finance at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. She says that may be true, there was some politicization, but the facts are solid as well. Linda Bilmes advised the committee on the new report. She also presented her own numbers when she testified before Congress last month. She's been with us before to talk about the cost of war and joined us again today. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And you did a report back in January of 2006. You co-authored a paper with Dr. Joseph Stiglitz that estimated the cost of the Iraq war alone would be more than $2 trillion. We're hearing so many numbers. Can you break down the categories that you see as you put the numbers together?
I think you can think about this in five main categories. The first category is the money that we've already spent, the $600 or so billion that has been spent on the war. The second category is the money that we will need to spend, the continued operating costs of continuing to pay for the war. And the third cost that people are less familiar with are what I call the promissory notes of the war. In other words, the money that we have already promised to spend to take care of veterans and to provide them with disability compensation.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are costs that are hidden but are costs to the federal government. For example, the increased cost of recruiting in the Defense Department, the increased cost of Social Security disability compensation for wounded veterans. And there are also things that economists call social costs, which include the cost of people staying home from work, the cost of the quality of life impairment of severely wounded veterans, and the cost of the loss of economic output from people who have been killed or disabled in the war. Mm-hmm. Finally, there are economic costs, which are, for example, some portion of the increase in the price of oil.
Okay, I want to go through these categories. Let's start with the promissory notes, as you call them, the costs that even if we pulled out of Iraq tomorrow, these are promised to be paid. You break these down into categories of, you know, veterans' disability, veterans' medical care. Tell us more about these, the numbers that go with these categories.
To date, there have already been 263,000 veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan who have been treated for medical disabilities of one sort or another in the Veterans Health Administration. Then, in addition, there are over 50,000 soldiers who have come back with post-traumatic stress disorder. So the cost over the long term of providing medical care to all of the veterans from this war when they come home, I mean, that number alone will be between $300 and $400 billion.
And remind us, we've spoken of this before, but why this is so profoundly different after this conflict than after other conflicts. There are so many more soldiers surviving.
Oh, that's right. If you look at back to the Vietnam era or the Korean War, there were approximately 2.5 soldiers who were wounded and survived for everyone who was killed. Now, in this war, there are 8 soldiers who survive wounded in combat for everyone who is killed. And if you take the full range of injuries and diseases, there are 15 to 16 soldiers who are wounded or injured for every one fatality. So really the very significant difference in this war compared with previous wars is the survival rate.
And we rush to say, and you say this as well in your testimony before Congress and in your report, it's harsh to hear of these lives discussed in this way as numbers, as figures. But it's so profoundly important to note that while it's wonderful that these soldiers have come back, society has to recognize there's a cost to caring for them.
Well, that's right. I think that the advances in care have been truly extraordinary. I've worked quite a lot with Dr. Gene Bowles, who was the chief neurosurgeon at Langsdorf Air Force Base in Germany. You know, he said, and he's a 30-year military veteran who was in Vietnam, that he has never seen injuries as severe as the ones that he saw that came from Iraq. We have not, as a society, come to grips with the fact that over the long term we will have to take care of these soldiers, and that is a very expensive proposition.
What are some of the other costs of the so-called promissory notes?
The second major promissory note is the cost of providing veterans with disability compensation. Now, in the first Gulf War, which lasted, as you recall, for a month, there were 700,000 U.S. soldiers involved, and 44% of them claimed disability compensation. So we now spend over $4 billion a year paying disability compensation for first Gulf War veterans from 1991. If you assume that the same percentage, 44% of the current soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan claim disability compensation, we're expecting anywhere from 700,000 to 900,000 soldiers to qualify for disability benefits. The final sort of category in terms of promissory notes is the Social Security disability compensation, which is in addition to the veterans' disability compensation. The Social Security disability compensation has a very simple criteria. Anyone who cannot work will get that. So that is another form of compensation that we will give to soldiers who are very severely injured or who have such severe mental illnesses that they can no longer work. What we understand from previous studies is that about one-third of soldiers who contract post-traumatic stress disorder can no longer work and will probably qualify for Social Security disability compensation.
And this is a Social Security system that's already strained.
That's right.
And I'm not sure if this is where to introduce this idea that you write about, but, you know, as we pay out money that vets need, you talk about how low it is compared to, for instance, when insurance companies pay after the loss, let's say, of a civilian life. You talk about something called the VSL, the value of statistical life.
The value of statistical life is a standard estimate of the economic output of a life. It's something that insurance companies use, and it's something that the U.S. government uses in estimating damage from environmental disasters, from workplace injuries, and so forth. They estimate that the value of a statistical life is about $7 million. Now, the military, the value of a statistical life that it uses, that it pays, is $500,000. So that's much, much less than in the civilian government. That's how much the family of a service member who is killed receives. So if you just think about that government civilian value of statistical life figure as a way of estimating the cost of the more than 4,000 U.S. soldiers who have been killed, that's over $30 billion in sort of economic loss. And I think that even though it sounds very cold and harsh to translate it into numbers, on the other hand, it's also cold and harsh not to recognize that our economy suffers from the loss of more than 4,000 young people in the prime of their lives.
Well, and that if the families were paid the way civilian families were paid by an insurance company after a loss, it would be upwards of seven times that number.
We just, as a society, are not coming to terms with the economic loss of a young people.
Linda Bilmes is professor of budgeting and public finance at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. We want to talk more with her about the social and economic costs of the war, lost productivity, higher oil prices. Some of her critics say, you can't really put numbers on those, so we're going to do that after a break. And by the way, as always, we welcome your thoughts on this or any topic on the program. But if you're seized now to write, do so at here-now.org. That's HERE-NOW.org. Also, later today, scientists have cloned monkey embryos, a step forward for stem cell research, but is it too close for comfort to cloning people? Well, an ethicist says, don't panic. We'll hear why. Back in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with more from Linda Bilmes, professor of public finance at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. She testified before Congress recently on the costs of the war in Iraq, costs beyond the day-to-day operation. Linda, let's move to things people may not think about, the hidden costs. You refer to them as social costs as well, such as the lost productivity of vets who can no longer work. But it goes beyond the veterans. You say that the families who have service members who were wounded in Iraq, one in five has a family member who has to give up a job to take care of a disabled veteran.
When we think about the social cost, one of the costs that we do not account for anywhere, which is a cost that the government doesn't pay but someone pays, is the cost of taking care of veterans when they come home, which usually falls on a wife or a mother or a family member or someone in the community who has to rearrange their life pretty substantially. And even if they are rearranging their life to drive somebody for rehabilitation for 3 years to a far distant rehabilitation center, or if they're rearranging their life in terms of jobs, caretaking, and so forth, there is a real cost there which we don't take into account.
I want to take a look at some of the non-human costs. Military equipment costs. You write the military says it's going to need $10 to $15 billion to replace the equipment that's just been worn down.
The very harsh terrain in the region, the very difficult conditions, the heavy usage is wearing up equipment far, far faster than we would have expected. Mm. So both now and in the future, the military faces an enormous expense in what's called reset, which is basically restoring the armed forces, the National Guard, and all the services to their pre-Iraq levels of readiness and equipment storage.
Well, now we come into an area that you briefly mentioned when we began, and there's been some criticism of this. You say that there is some cost of the rise of oil, the price of oil, that can be attributed to the Iraq war. Robert Hormats, who's vice chair of Goldman Sachs, a member of the National Security Council under several presidents, he agrees with you and Congress that wars are costlier than we're recognizing. But he says you really can't tie the rising oil prices or lower investment in the U.S. economy to the Iraq war. Now, you write that high oil prices and the resulting higher interest rates dampened our trading partners' economies and ours, and the result is they bought less from the U.S. And this is where people are saying, I don't know if you can tie that to the war. How do you tie that to the war?
If you think back, and I think common sense dictates that we do this, if you think back to the eve of the invasion of the war nearly 5 years ago, the price of a barrel of oil was $23. It's now over $100. And the futures markets, which what they do is they anticipate what's going to happen. The futures markets in 2003 already predicted with pretty good accuracy the increase in demand in China, the increase in demand in India, the instability in Venezuela. So the question is, what happened? Well, the only thing, apart from the sort of temporary glitch in refining after Hurricane Katrina, the only thing that happened in the past 5 years to really change that trajectory was the invasion of Iraq and the resulting instability in the region. So we would argue very strongly that some of the increase in the oil price is attributable to that decision to invade and to the resulting instability. And if you think about it, I mean, it just makes sense that because of the fact that we are paying so much more for oil, consumers have less money in their pockets. We are not spending as much on other things. We're not spending as much on investments in the U.S. And companies and businesses that invest are also having to spend a lot more money on fuel prices and have a lot less money to invest.
At the same time, though, we hear about a roaring economy. Look at that stock market, you know, rise. And there's a disconnect. Is part of the equation here that Americans really aren't paying for the war? There's no war tax.
When we think about this war, I mean, this war has been borne by a very, very small percentage of the population. So the sort of blood cost has been very low for most people. The cost in treasure has also been borne by a very small percentage because most of the money to wage the war has been borrowed. That means that we've essentially passed that cost on to the next generations. There has been no war tax. Indeed, the tax, as we know, on wealthy people has been lowered. And all of that money has to be repaid with interest. So if you think about the interest that we have already paid on what we have already borrowed, that is $85 billion that's already been spent. So every year we are adding more and more to our accumulated national debt, which is now over $9 trillion. Now, where do we borrow from? We borrow in the markets. A very significant percentage of our borrowings come from abroad, particularly from China. And many have made the point that foreign economies have, to a large extent, financed our ability to pay for the war.
This is where Hormats and others completely agree with you. They're concerned that the war is largely being financed by foreign debt and China.
It is a unprecedented situation that we have a war that is financed almost entirely by debt, and that debt is financed largely by foreign countries.
You're right. Imagine, you know, if we'd spent all of this money at home.
if we had spent all of this money at home, we could have funded Social Security for the next 50 years. We could have provided universal health care to children. We could have done some of the big things, the big ticket items that are very expensive that we have not had the money, essentially, to do. And we spent the money instead on the war in Iraq.
Well, and Linda Bilmes, again from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, when you say things like that, as you well know, that's sort of like a political flag goes up. Is this from a political point of view, or are you, you know, are you the mathematician crunching the numbers?
I feel very strongly that this is a nonpartisan issue. Regardless of how you feel about the war, the question is, how much did it cost? It's impossible for us to make an accurate decision about whether the benefits of the war are worth the cost if we don't know what the cost is.
Professor Bilmes, thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you, Robin.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, animals do it, countries do it, maybe you do it, scapegoating or misplaced aggression. An expert says it may be physically healthy for the person who's doing it, disastrous for the recipient. We'll have that story. Also tomorrow, composer and conductor Maria Schneider. Don't miss that. Still ahead today, ethical considerations as scientists clone monkey embryos. Back after the news, Here and Now. Remember Dolly, the cloned sheep? 10 years ago, her arrival sparked a worldwide debate about cloning. What would be next, people worried? Humans? Well, our next guest wasn't worried about that then, and he says there's still no reason to panic about the most recent cloning news, that researchers in Oregon have begun have been able to clone monkey embryos. The worry would be that cloning monkeys, which are closely related to humans, is a step much closer to cloning people. Well, medical ethicist Arthur Kaplan joins us from the University of Pennsylvania, where he's the chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and director of the Center for Bioethics. So, Art, okay, you say you're not panicking, but you are watching this closely.
I've often said when somebody clones a monkey, call me up, and then we'll be interested in what might be done with humans.
Well, we're calling you.
And the Oregon group is very reliable. You may recall that there was an announcement of cloned human embryos out of Korea about a year ago, which turned out to be a gigantic fraud. So these people not only announced it, they reconfirmed it. They had another team do it. So there's no doubt that it's been done. I think people worry as soon as they hear this and think, well, when's the clone moving into my neighborhood? But that isn't the pursuit here. The goal in cloning embryos is to try and find a source of embryonic stem cells that will work very well in people who have diseases. They can use it to make their own self-repair kits.
Because if the stem cell has the same genetic material as the person it was cloned from, it's less likely to be rejected.
Not only less likely, it won't be. If you clone cells from your own skin cells or tongue cells, that's going to be genetically 100% identical to you. You will not need to take any drugs. It won't be rejected. It should implant and function optimally. So the excitement in the science is, could we clone human embryos and then have a kind of absolute best shot at finding repair kits for various diseases?
So this is good news for people who have that goal. But, you know, the concern is that people who don't have that goal, people who are looking to clone human beings, make an exact reproduction of themselves for, you know, egotistical reasons or whatever the reasons. And that's the concern people have today when they hear that science is one step closer to cloning humans.
Well, I think it's possible, both in the United States and worldwide, to legislate in this area and not hinder the research use of cloning. We don't have a law in the United States, do not, that prohibits human cloning for reproduction. If some nut or kook or cultist in a Starfleet uniform wanted to try and do this tomorrow using the Oregon techniques, they could and they wouldn't be breaking any law. If a private company wanted to try to do it without public money, they could. So we need that law. There's no doubt about it. We also need an international agreement, a convention that says human reproductive cloning is off limits, certainly until it's been demonstrated to be safe, reliably safe, in monkeys and other primates. So I think we can draw a bright line between research cloning and reproductive cloning and outlaw, or at least temporarily ban, human cloning.
Well, in the meantime, we understand one of the reasons that you and other ethicists are not, you know, panicking quite yet is that it was very, very hard to do this cloning procedure with monkeys. The more sophisticated a being becomes, and monkeys are far more sophisticated than, let's say, sheep, the more difficult it is.
That's right. I have been watching closely all the data coming out of animal cloning. It's still the case that when you're down in more distant species from us, goats and pigs and sheep, you're getting a success rate in producing an adult animal of about 1 in 5. And of those animals, a fair number are very sick and die prematurely. So right off the bat, cloning is dangerous. Now, the Oregon team tried to clone for reproduction. They tried to make a monkey, not a cells, but a whole monkey using their technique. They couldn't do it. They tried 50 times. It didn't work. Now, I'm not going to say it'll never work, but it's clearly very difficult to get a healthy organism out of cloning. And I think that's probably going to take the procedure off limits in terms of reproduction. Even a nut who went out on an island and said, I'm going to do this and I don't care, I want to be first, would need dozens of women to agree to try this because you'd have to do it 50, 100, 150 times. And you'd need tons of doctors and tons of scientists. I don't even think you could do it and keep it secret.
And just a reminder that the process is that you take some DNA, some skin cells, from in this case the monkey, then you take some monkey eggs and you treat the eggs and inject the new DNA material into the eggs,
right,
and then have to coax them. And so you do need the woman to provide the eggs.
You need the women to bear the children. So if you're going for 1 in 50, you got to find 50 willing surrogate mothers here.
And yet, Arthur Kaplan, has this whole science gone faster than you would have thought a few years ago?
It has. I would have thought that the ability to clone monkey embryos or human embryos would still be out there maybe another 5-10 years distant. So this is a jump and a significant leap, basically changing the chemicals that were used from the ones used in Dolly to things a little less toxic turned out to be the key. So that's surprising, and that's why I won't say that human beings can't be cloned. We can't get grown-up adults out of it. Maybe we'll learn some more and learn it faster than I think. But I have a feeling the procedure creates embryos, the so-called clone embryos, that are fundamentally flawed, that have problems. You're using old DNA from body cells to do it. There's changes in there, mutations in there. I have a feeling that's not the best way to try and make a healthy human being or a healthy adult monkey. So I suspect we're going to find out that this is useful for research, and we need to regulate that and figure out how to proceed in that area. But I think the ban on reproductive cloning, we need to start thinking about that tomorrow.
Meanwhile, while we have you, we had a rancher on the program yesterday who is in the business of cloning cattle.
Uh-huh.
And the FDA told ranchers a year ago that they feel that there's no difference between byproduct of cloned animals, meat and milk, and natural meat and milk. And yet they asked them not to sell it. And this fellow has decided he can't wait. He's already sold some offspring on the market. He says there's absolutely no difference, no reason to label it, no reason to let people know that it's meat from the offspring of cloned animals. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, my thought is, well, good luck with that strategy. Leaking cloned meat products, milk products into the food supply will drive consumers absolutely nuts. So I think you're in a situation here where it may be true that cloned meat is safe or milk from cloned cows is safe, but the consumer has an absolute right to know what they're eating.
Well, his response to that is, well, then the FDA needs to do something about that because he feels the FDA has been dragging its feet. Do you think the FDA needs to sort of come to some conclusion on what to do with these cloned animals?
I do, and I think they need to get an agreement that for all of our foods, whatever we would like to find out, if not on the label, then somewhere on a website, it's going to describe how the food was made, whether the FDA believes it to be safe or not. But I think consumers deserve much more information about how genetics is being applied to animal and plant food than they're getting now.
Arthur Kaplan, Chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, thank you, as always, for giving us your opinion.
My pleasure.
Okay, we just want to give you a heads up on some stories that we're going to be following in the near future. With oil prices fluctuating in the $90-plus dollar a barrel range, OPEC nations gather in Saudi Arabia next week. We'll have a report. Also, ahead of the shopping season, Wired magazine has the top-of-the-line gadgets of the season. Plasma TVs really coming down in price, you know, under $1,000. And it's Thanksgiving week. We'll have some recipes for you. That's all next week. You're listening to Here Now. Well, soccer fans, this is your weekend and perhaps the one time you want to have those hugely expensive plasma TVs. The New England Revolution are going to find out if they finally win their first Major League Soccer Cup in three straight tries or lose another and risk becoming the Buffalo Bills of the soccer world. The Revolution meet the Houston Dynamo in Washington on Sunday in a replay of last year's title game, which the Dynamo won in penalty kicks. Here to talk about soccer, host of the NPR show Only a Game, and soccer fan, Bill Littlefield. Bill, welcome as always.
Thank you, Robin.
And so what do you think, of course, the Buffalo Bills reference meaning?
Well, the Bills lost four Super Bowls in a row and, of course, lost the fourth one, and the third and the fourth one by fairly hideous scores. So the Revolution, they certainly don't want to travel into that territory.
And can't win, you know, you don't want to be the one who can't win the big game.
That's
The Dynamo are the defending champions, so what do you think is going to happen?
Well, first of all, the Revolution did win the U.S. Open Cup earlier this season, so they can win the big game. We'll see if they can win another big game in the same year. The Dynamo is an extraordinary team, especially defensively. They set a record this year for fewest goals allowed, which, of course, in soccer is very important. They have a terrific goalie in Pat Onstad. The Revolution's also very strong defensively. They may get a bit of a lift in the fact that Brian Ching will not be playing. Apparently, he's doubtful for Houston, and he's important up front for them.
And you like New England player Taylor Twellman, who uses this bicycle kick to score.
Well, he used a bicycle kick against Chicago in the conference final. I'm not sure how often he has done that in the course of his career. He scored in a great many ways. But I think even he was perhaps surprised at the result of that particular kick. It was quite flamboyant.
And I just want to say, also in the world of soccer, this week the U.S. Women's National Team announced it has a new coach. You've met her?
Yes, I have. Pia Sundhage was the coach of the Breakers in the third year of their existence before the league was suspended. And I love her because not only is she has a history as a great player in Sweden, but also she is so excited and enthusiastic about what she does that sometimes she sings in press conferences. And I have never before encountered a coach who did that, and I found it quite delightful.
We've been talking soccer and, as always, a few things more with Bill Littlefield, host of the NPR show Only a Game. Bill, thanks for the heads up.
Thank you, Robin.
This week, we lost a literary giant, but that prompted a beautiful memory for 82-year-old Athena Giftis Lydotis of North Reading, Massachusetts, a memory of a train ride she took in December of 1942 from Chicago to Portland, Maine.
This was when I was 17. I was a piano major at Chicago Musical College. I was going home for my first Christmas home, and I had packed a huge black suitcase with practically all the clothes I own. It was extremely heavy. When I went to the station, I see three soldiers who are headed towards me, and I was having difficulty with my suitcase, and they were all vying for it.
They were flirting with you quite a bit, weren't
they? Yes, they were. They all wanted to take my suitcase. One of them went out, and we sat together, and we're talking, and he had fabulous sandwiches. I'll never forget them. Fully packed, very good. His grandmother had made them.
What was the train like, by the way? How long were you on it?
36 hours. We had pillows and blankets and, slept the night through. Mm-hmm. And we were talking, and asked me what I did, and I told him, and then I asked him what he did. And he said, very confidently and very, firmly, I'm a writer. And I was quite taken aback by that. He was only 19. You didn't meet anybody who would say that confidently, I'm a writer, at that age. And then I realized later, in the later years, my goodness, he really was a writer. He became a famous personality, Norman Mailer. It just was so cute, just so amazing. I just always have been taken, with this story. And that's the story of the night I slept with Norman Mailer.
Gee, I wonder if ever in any of his books he wrote of a night on a train, on a wooden bench.
I've wondered the same thing. I don't know. I would love, it would be fun to know that.
Well, Norman Mailer fans, let us know. Of course, the legendary author Norman Mailer died earlier this week at the age of 84. Back in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Like many African-American neighborhoods, Houston's Third Ward was a skeleton of its former self. Integration meant those who could afford to leave and live in white suburbs did. Huge highways then cut through and displaced others. The crack epidemic of the 1980s decimated what was left. Then an enterprising group of artists came and revitalized a group of old shotgun shacks. Project Row Houses transformed a neighborhood and saved it. But then developers came. Will the longtime residents be displaced?
The lot was vacant for numerous of years, and then all of a sudden, here come the devil, this monsters of a building.
Why should I sell what's mine and then look at trying to rebuild or sell or purchase another property when what we have is already paid for?
I keep telling everybody, y'all forget the history of Houston. It was founded by a pair of brothers who were real estate developers. And they meant that, you know.
Residents of Third Ward, Texas, which is also the name of a new documentary that tells of an incredible integration of art and housing. Rick Lowe is the artist who founded Project Row Houses. He joins us from KUHF in Houston, Texas. Welcome.
Good to be here.
We're also joined by Andy Garrison, director of Third Ward, Texas. He joins us from KUT in Austin. Welcome to you as well, Andy.
Thank you.
And Rick, I want to start with you. One of 12 children, you were raised in what you've said was the last sharecropping family in Alabama. You studied art with the artist John Biggers, who painted African-American street life. But then a young person visited you and got you out of the studio and into the Third Ward. Tell us that exchange.
A group of high school students from one of the local high schools were visiting my studio and looking at these big political paintings and sculptures that I was making at the time. And the student basically, at the point they were leaving, he turned back and he said, "Well, Mr. Lowe, that's not what we need. We don't need people to tell us what the issues are. We need solutions. And if you're creative, why can't you create some kind of solution?" And that was a turning point in my career, to push my creativity in a way that went beyond creating work that was only symbolic and poetic to being work that had a practical application.
And what you did was you found these row houses with the tin roofs had been completely abandoned in the Third Ward, and with volunteers, and then soon it grew into an organization. You gave them rebirth. I mean, just describe that, the early part of the project, and just seeing that transformation and change.
There was a group of 7 artists, I was included in that group, that were fairly determined to figure out how we could become a resource to an African-American community, as we were all somewhat resources to the mainstream art institutions. We wanted to figure out how we could make an impact on our own communities. We got permission to work on the site. We started cleaning and clearing the site. And the next thing, children from the neighborhood start coming over. And then their parents were curious about what their children were doing, and they would come over. And it was a beautiful process of people coming together, kind of nurturing back a place that had lost its value.
It's really quite compelling to see it. There's after-school education there now. There's housing. There's these visiting artist installations. And just if you would describe how the installations part of this worked and what some of the installations looked like.
Neighborhoods like Third Ward, before integration, were not nearly as isolated as they are now. Mm-hmm. They had exposure to the world based on people traveling to their neighborhoods because there weren't integrated downtown hotels. There are stories of Count Basie living in the Overton's house down the street from us. Booker T. Washington stayed in the neighborhood when he came to town. And so with the Artist Projects Program, we have artists that come into our neighborhood from all over, from China, Brazil, Nigeria, all over Europe, all over the U.S. And it gives a kind of exposure to the world, to people in our communities that's not customary in low-income neighborhoods.
I'm thinking also of another scene, an older man named Donnell Long, who's the brother of one of the artists that you worked with. He's a longtime resident. And I don't think that he is an artist by profession, but here he describes a piece of work that he did. It was an image of a child in a tree, very beautiful in its primitiveness. Let's listen.
My father, he was killed on his job. He fell off in a barrel of steel and left my mother with 3 kids and 1 to be born. I used to climb these 2 big trees, and I used to just be out there praying. And I used to climb that tree because I was afraid and didn't have no father. And I was so lost and afraid. finally I had a little more hope.
A very powerful example of what Project Row Houses has done for, you know, just one resident. Andy Garrison, director of Third Ward, Texas, what did you see through your lens of, you know, the impact of these houses and this art that suddenly bloomed in the neighborhood?
There's a number of emblematic images to me. Donnell's piece that you've played a little from is wonderful. And even the little boy who's dancing in the street and turns and happens to notice there's a camera shooting him and laughs about it. Walking along with the two photographers, seeing them shoot, seeing them have conversations with people, that really cemented this idea of relationships in neighborhoods for me as a filmmaker. It felt like a stimulating place. It felt like a kind of place that, you know, I wish my neighborhood was like this.
Well, it had a young mother's residency program. Young women who were struggling with children and also maybe perhaps trying to be artists would have the opportunity for 1 or 2 year residency. But then, as the story progresses, the neighborhood becomes more appealing. So enter developers and gentrification. You know, there's suddenly houses that are for sale, people trying to buy houses out from under other people. At this point, Rick, this has gotten so much bigger than you ever could have thought.
Well, developers were going to come to this neighborhood because there was a renewed interest in it, and we played a big part in renewing that interest. We figured it out fairly soon in our process that we needed to pose ourselves to be developers ourselves. And so we started to acquire property, and it's giving us the opportunity to have some presence in the future development.
Here's one of those developers and architect, Larry Davis. And while he's taking away some of the character of the neighborhood, destroying some of the older homes, he says he's providing affordable housing for others. Let's listen.
I don't think that we can be, as a developer, condemned or rewarded. You know, I think you do have to have a reality check and say, if we didn't come in, it's not going to change. It's going to stay the same because no one's really helping these people. Where do they go? Maybe they go to suburbia. I don't know where they go.
So, Andy, as your film ends, we see the huge success of Rick's work, but also the irony that brings us. We just heard, you know, his success attracts developers. Are you worried that that development is going to erode the old neighborhood that you documented and Rick saved?
You know, we would ask Rick that question, and we would ask other people that question. And, you know, you're faced with the same kind of answer. It's change is going to happen. How can you influence that change? And I'm just so impressed by the route that Project Row Houses that Rick and the whole group have taken to try and affect that change so that the neighborhood can retain some of the connections it has.
Rick Lowe, what do you see the future of your project? I mean, for instance, your Project Row Houses are beautiful, probably could sell for a lot of money, and you'd raise a lot of money, but there would go your project.
I think we'll have awkwardly placed townhouses in the midst of hopefully properties that we will preserve that kind of reflect the old way of building in this community. It'll be a mix, and the new townhouses will just be kind of uninteresting frames for the nice gems that we'll have in the middle of the neighborhood.
That's Rick Lowe, artist and founder of Project Row Houses. We also were speaking with Andy Garrison, director of Third Ward, Texas, the film about the changes that came about in the Third Ward of Texas after Rick and other artists decided to go in and put their art right in the neighborhood. To see more about the film and the Project Row Houses, go to here-now.org. Rick and Andy, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Sure.
Thank you.
Fall in, everybody. The joint is packed. We got room for more. Keep it coming in the door. That's a house party tonight. That's a house party tonight.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.